talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Leute, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the story of the Irish from our earliest ancestors to today's global diaspora. We'll be taking a trip through 10,000 years of our island's history. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. From that small island, The Story of the Irish is an ambitious new documentary series that takes us on a sweeping journey from Ireland's earliest settlers to our modern-day global diaspora. It explores who we are, where we came from, and what it means to be Irish. Narrated by Colin Farrell and filmed across 17 countries, it weaves together archaeology, genetics, literature and history in a groundbreaking way. The programme will be broadcast on RTE Television over 4 weeks, starting on Sunday the 8th of June. And to preview the series and explore our island story, I'm delighted to welcome three people closely involved in its making. Professor Brianna McDiarmida is the Thomas J. and Kathleen O'Donnell Professor Emerita of Irish Studies at the University of Notre Dame. A writer, academic and filmmaker, she wrote and produced the multi-award-winning documentary series 1916, The Irish Rebellion, narrated by Liam Neeson, and is the writer and producer of From That Small Island. Professor Jane Olmeyer is Erasmus Smith's Professor of Modern History at Trinity College Dublin, one of Ireland's leading historians and a pioneer of the public humanities. Historical consultant for the series, she is also the co-author with Brianna of the book that will accompany the series. Professor Eileen Murphy is a distinguished bioarchaeologist and is professor in the School of Natural and Built Environment at Queen's University Belfast, and she's an expert on human skeleton populations recovered from all periods of Irish history. Well, you're all very welcome. And Brianna, we might begin with you and we might go back in time to the 1916 documentary you were involved in, which was a huge success, narrated by Liam Neeson, reached a global audience. Tell us about that project, but also that the genesis of this project lay in that one.
Absolutely, Patrick. So I started thinking about 1916, about the centenary of 1916, in about 2008, probably, which is really early. So we got in very early. I was in the University of Notre Dame at the time. And so we managed to finance the whole thing through the university, through really generous benefactors and philanthropy. And also, of course, RTE then came in. We coincided with the centenary, with the decade of commemorations, but of course with the centenary. And the DFA came in and asked, could they show it around the world in embassies? So we joined up with universities, with embassies, with cultural organisations, and literally showed it in five continents. So it was quite incredible. So we had Liam Neeson do the narration. We had an original score by the Patrick Cassidy, and I suppose what it went down really, really well. I remember showing it in Belfast, in a cinema in South Belfast. And we were sort of a little bit in fear and trepidation there. And the number of people that came up and said, do you know, that was very fair. So it really got out there and it got out to many different audiences. But I suppose the genesis of this project really came from that because, as I say, we brought it around the world. We had conferences, which we called Reframing 1916. So we're engaging with people, with academic communities, with, as I said, diasporic groups, if that's how you put it. But the questions that came up then was, why is Irish history so cool? I mean, why are people interested in the history of this tiny little island? I was at a film festival in Pinamar in Argentina. Actually, that was the world premiere and we won an audience award there. But people came up to me at the end and they wanted to speak, and I don't speak Spanish to my eternal shame, but they kept touching their heart and they're saying, Corazon a Corazon. So I suppose, the emotional heft of the story, particularly of 1916, you know, it really became universal, right? So those questions, and you look at the fact that 70 million people in the world say they're Irish. What on earth does that mean? Do you know? And some of them have very tangential connections with Ireland. But why is it kind of cool to be Irish? What is it about the Irish story that kind of inspires people? And of course, there are aspects of that Irish story that certainly wouldn't inspire, quite the opposite. So, and I'm thinking, wouldn't it be great to go on now and to do another documentary series that would look at a much, much larger time frame? I mean, that was one event. Obviously, it had precedents and antecedents and the things that followed on a hugely seminal event, needless to say. But with this, I thought it would be great to go right back to the very beginning and come up to today. So the scope and time is like immense, but then also location. So where did the Irish go? First of all, where did the Irish come from and where did the Irish go? So it's the comings and goings. I think Mary McAleese put a beauty like that. The comings and goings of an island people. So then I was out in Brazil, as you would, and there I met Professor Jane Allmayer, as you do. And we started talking and Jane said she'd really enjoyed 1916. She'd shown it. She was out in India, I believe, and had used it to show her class, something of the backstory of the Irish Revolution. And then she said, what are you doing next? I said, well, I've got this great idea. I'd love to do the global story of the Irish as well as going back internally. So to look at how the island sits in the world. And Jane said, oh, that sounds really interesting. I said, what are you doing? And she said, oh, well, I'm doing this book on empire. I said, well, why don't you come and do this with me as well? Help me develop this. And that's the genesis, Patrick.
And so a beautiful friendship was formed and a beautiful creative partnership. And Jane, what's really interesting is it kind of builds on a lot of work that you'd been doing professionally in terms of being, say, for example, Trinity's first and founding vice provost for global relations, your role as director of the Trinity Long Room Hub, your role developing that book on empire, the Ford lectures, and we've talked about these on the show before, that it kind of was, it kind of came at that perfect time in terms of your own research and your own career.
It really did, Patrick. And it was such a privilege for me to join this amazing creative team, Brianna, and then two colleagues from Coco TV, Linda Cullen and Stuart Switzer. And, you know, as historians, we're delighted if a couple of hundred people read one of our books, maybe a couple of thousand if we're really lucky. But the opportunity to tell our story for millions and tens of millions, potentially, of people is so utterly exciting, really scary as well. So Brian and I met back in 2016, and I'm sure we've had a daily conversation thereafter. We've collaborated really, really, really closely. Obviously, I am a historian, though. Brian is a filmmaker and a script writer, and the skill set needed to produce very sort of high quality documentaries, as I believe this one is very different. So I think we all bring different things to the table. The collaboration is fantastic. But also then, as you've just alluded to, I have been privileged to travel the world for Trinity and have managed to tap into these amazing, largely Irish studies programs everywhere from, you know, India to Brazil, and of course across North America, continental Europe. And I think this program will be of particular value to that network. And hopefully there'll be lots and lots of workshops and opportunities for screenings so we can discuss, well, what does it mean to be Irish in the 21st century, the 12th century, the 17th century? And then, of course, at a personal level, it really ties into all of my work on Ireland as colony and Ireland on the world stage as part of the British and other European empires. So it's been the most probably demanding, intellectually stimulating and most fun project that anybody could wish for. I've absolutely loved it.
And I think you were amazed that you'd go somewhere and you'd find that there was an Irish connection or an Irish link or a monument to some Irish figure, so that you were finding and making these connections everywhere you went.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you just one example. Last year, I'd always wanted to walk the Inca Trail. I'm fascinated by ancient empires and wanted to go to Machu Picchu. So after I'd been to Machu Picchu, I went down into the Amazon, the Peruvian Amazon, to a place called Iquitos. And whose picture do I see on the walls? Roger Casement. And I was like, oh my goodness, what's Roger Casement doing here? And then, of course, it became clear that he's revered is both in Brazil and Peru as their first humanitarian. He basically told the story of how the rubber barons had enslaved the local indigenous Indians and blew the whistle on that. And then I did a little bit of deeper research, and I found, much to my horror, that Iquitos was founded by a man called Fitzcarraldo or Fitzgerald, whose mother was Peruvian, but his father was Irish, and that the overseers on the estates, many of them were of Ireland, including from Donegal. So it was one of these moments where you just see literally the Irish everywhere, including in the Peruvian Amazon. But I don't think there's a country that I've ever visited where I've not found some sort of Irish influence, whether it's part of the spiritual empire, the Franciscans, the Jesuits, the Protestant churches, or as part of one of the European empires.
Brianna, how stressful was it to try and tell the story over four episodes? Because it is a great story, but, you know, it would be very easy to do it over 50 episodes and you could really let the story breathe and you could explore all these parts of the world. How difficult was it to make those decisions about how to craft it into something that showed the wide range and breadth of the story, but also was coherent as a story within that time frame?
I can answer that in one word, Patrick: immensely. It was immensely difficult to do that, but that was part of the challenge. And so we really worked collaboratively as a team. I initially wrote scripts, and I think, and we interviewed, of course, lots and lots and lots of top people. And that's, we only interviewed historians, archaeologists, scientists that were really top in the field, that were there at the cutting edge, that were bringing something of great value to the table for us, you know. So we had the overall, so we had to craft an overall story, but which had rigour and heft, as well as making compelling television. We also brought to the table Colin Farrell, which was amazing. I think anybody who watches this on television or in a cinema later on, I think they're going to just get how intimately he tells the story. It's his story, you know. He's really took ownership of it, and it's very understated, but it's really perfect, I have to say. We also have a wonderful, wonderful score composed by Colm McInerney, who's one of Ireland's really leading composers. And again, he speaks to both popular music, traditional music, classical music, world music. So I think he was such an addition to the whole overall thing. So, but as I say, we had something like, I started off with 280 hours of interviews, or certainly 200 hours of interviews. So we had location shooting in 17 different countries, and Jane came to at least three of those, I think. So Jane was in front of camera as well as behind the scenes. I stay very safely behind the camera, I have to say, for this one anyway. So I suppose the thing was trying to craft a story that, as you say, was coherent. And it goes literally from a cave, and we start off in a cave in North Cork, in Castlepook Cave, where a team of archaeologists are searching for our very first inhabitants. And as the archaeologist said to us, it's all to play for. We could find Neanderthals here. So, you know, the general belief was that Ireland did not have Paleolithic period. We didn't have anybody here. Now that's been questioned. And I suppose, again, that the whole, what science has brought to the table here, and I think I'm going to be speaking, I think, to Eileen, and she brought an awful lot to the table, that mixture of academic rigour, but also scientific rigour and cutting-edge techniques, all of the developments that have happened in science and in genetics, of course. Ancient DNA is huge, and Trinity is to the fore in that, with Dan Bradley and Lara Cassidy, and both of those took part in the work. So helpful. But that melding of new knowledge and new methods of acquiring knowledge, that was really important and central to the way we told our story.
Eileen, I might bring you in here on that broader point about new knowledge and new technologies and new ways of approaching the past, because I was fascinated to read about your work on human skeletal populations and how you are examining them from all periods of Irish history. That what techniques are you applying, and what can we learn from these studies?
Well, yes, so we can learn a huge amount of information about the people in the past from their actual skeletal remains. And that's one of the fantastic things about this series, you know, that it's not just focusing on people from the, you know, the relatively recent past. It's going all the way back, as Brianna said, you know, back to the start. We are sort of challenging a lot of the past perceptions through the use of scientific techniques. So Brianna mentioned the cave. So the archaeologists there are trying to get, you know, maybe the samples of sediment that they can then see if they can get ancient DNA from, that would then help them, you know, identify that people had been living on the island in Paleolithic times. But when we get a human skeleton, we want to know all about that past person, you know, what they were like during their lives and, you know, how they died and how they were buried. And we can, you know, look at a skeleton and work out, you know, a person's age when they died. If it's an adult, you know, if they were male or female. If it's a child, we can't work out their sex because they haven't sort of developed the sort of sexually dimorphic characteristics. We can look for things like their height, types of diseases they may have suffered from, and maybe evidence of, you know, weapon injuries, which tells us all about violence. So that would be kind of the osteoarchaeology. But now we've got lots of information from novel scientific techniques like stable isotopes that can tell us about, you know, what a person was eating, maybe where they came from. And then the amazing technology with ancient DNA analysis, which we're so fortunate to have, you know, a lab really at the top of the field in Trinity with Professor Dan Bradley and Dr. Lara Cassidy. And that can bring a whole suite of new information about people. So we can even, you know, tell a person's hair colour, their eye colour, their skin tone. We can tell, you know, what their genetics are. And, you know, then we can look at population movement. And this is really enriched our understanding of prehistoric archaeology, because there's been a lot of debate over the years about whether it was, you know, maybe like a change like the Neolithic, whether where we get lots of new technology and new funerary practices, whether it was movement of ideas or movement of actual people. And the DNA is now showing that it was actually people. And that makes perfect sense because Ireland is an island. So people had to come here across the sea. So we see these different waves of people moving with their, bringing their new technology with them to the island. And that forms our prehistoric and our archaeological record.
So is archaeology and is genetics rewriting Irish history before us?
Well, yes, I think the genetic information is really challenging ideas and when there were competing hypotheses and ideas, it's now been able to sort of prove this idea that people moved en masse. You know, so for example, in the early Bronze Age, we know that there was a mass migration of people from the Russian steppelands all the way across Europe, and they made it to Ireland. And we know this because one of the first ancient DNA analysis that Lara Cassidy and Dan Bradley undertook on an Irish individual proved this. It was on an early Bronze Age man who was buried on Rathlin Island, and it showed that he had this genetic signature from the Russian steppes. And that is actually, that signature is perpetuated right through to modern people living in Ireland. So we've got this genetic continuity from about 4,000 years ago.
It is extraordinary, Brianna.
It's absolutely fascinating. And in episode one, we actually, with Eileen, we go with Eileen to Face Lab, which is the cutting edge forensic laboratory in Liverpool, John Moores. And actually, given the genetic information that we got from the geneticist in Trinity through Eileen's study of the skeleton of this man that we were calling Rathlin Man, as you do, we were able to, I think television is such a compelling medium for something like this, because you could write it in a book so people are reading it and you see a photograph. Here we're with Eileen as she uncovers and sees for the first time what this individual would actually have looked like, scientifically accurate. Reconstruction of the face of this 4,500-year-old skeleton. And he comes to life before us on the television screen. And to see Eileen's reaction to it is also quite, quite wonderful. But it's a brilliant story. And again, I think, you know, as well as sort of the more abstract aspects of history and all of that stuff, what it does is it reminds us of the humanity of people from the deep past, that we can actually make human connections with these people. And I mean, what Eileen said when she saw him, she said, oh my goodness, she said, you could pass him on the street in Rathlin and you wouldn't look twice, you know, you wouldn't look sideways. He just looks like a person from Rathlin does today.
Well, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be taking a deep dive through the four episodes of the series, starting with episode one, From the Beginning. And we'll hear more about From This, a Small Island, after this break. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are previewing this brilliant new documentary series, From That Small Island. I'm joined by Professor Brianna McDiarmida, who is Professor Emerita of Irish Studies at the University of Notre Dame and is an award-winning writer, academic and filmmaker, and the writer and producer of From That Small Island. Professor Jane Ullmeyer, Erasmus Smith's Professor of Modern History at Trinity College Dublin, one of Ireland's leading historians and a pioneer of the public humanities, who is a historical consultant and closely involved in the making of From That Small Island, and the co-author with Brianna of the book that will accompany the series, and Professor Eileen Murphy, a distinguished bioarchaeologist and professor in the School of Natural and Built Environment at Queen's University Belfast, and an expert on human skeletal populations recovered from all periods in Irish history. Eileen, we might start there with episode one and all of this incredible material, and Brianna's been talking about Rathlin Man and what you can tell from Rathlin Man. Tell us about your experience there and what the reconstruction involved and what it means.
Okay, so the Rathlin Man, as we're calling him, so he dated to the early Bronze Age, so it was about 4,000 years ago, and he was excavated. It was part of a rescue excavation a number of years ago by our Centre for Community Archaeology, because his burial was eroding out of the sort of sand dunes. But we didn't realise at the time just how amazing, you know, his story was going to be. So, you know, I did the basic sort of osteological analysis on him, and I was able to say, you know, he was quite an old man for his time. You know, he was between sort of 40 and 60. He was also quite tall. He was about 5'11". And he was buried in a stone kist along with a pot. So he was probably quite a high status individual. And then we were able to add on the genetic information by Professor Bradley and Dr. Cassidy. And this then, you know, told us about his sort of genetics related to the Russian steppe people. But it also told us some really interesting things, like he was lactose tolerant, whereas the previous people wouldn't have been able to tolerate milk. And he also was a carrier for a condition called hemochromatosis, which is a really, you know, it's a condition where you get iron overload, and it's very prevalent in modern people from Ireland today as well. And then, you know, it was almost like a dream come through that as part of this TV series, we were able to get his facial reconstruction undertaken. Mm-hmm. And we knew from the genetics that he would have had, you know, light brown hair, brown eyes, and probably like quite pale skin. But that information and a copy of the individual skull was sent over to the laboratory, the face lab over in Liverpool, John Moores University. And they were then able to, you know, recreate how he would have looked like in life. And the team, we all went over then to the lab to actually, you know, see the unveiling of the image. And it was just incredible, because this is a person I'd been studying, you know, for many years, and we'd been gradually learning more and more about this man. And then to actually see, you know, what he would have looked like was, you know, looking into his eyes, if you like, you know, it was quite an emotional experience. It was, you know, because he just looked like one of us. You know, he just looked like somebody you'd pass on the street on Rathlin, as Brianna said. So it was incredible. And I think people will find that very powerful, you know, that we've got such a level of sort of archaeological science that we can, you know, really bring people from the deep past, you know, almost back to life, if you like.
Brianna, can I ask you about saints and scholars and how important they are to the way Ireland sees its past, and indeed to the way we kind of see ourselves?
Yeah, that's really interesting, Patrick. Of course, Christianity totally transformed Ireland with the coming of Patrick. Not just Patrick, obviously, but the change from pre-Christian Ireland to Christianised Ireland in a very relatively short period of time. And also, I suppose, how Christianity became indigenised. I think that's really an important point, that it wasn't so much conflict as indigenisation, almost colonisation in one sense, of what was there in the past and changing it to new purposes. But this idea then that Ireland was an island of saints and scholars, and people scoff at that, you know, they think that's just, oh, there's the Irish gang blowing their own trumpets and all of that. Actually, when you look at it, it's totally true. We were an island of saints and scholars. We weren't simply an island of saints and scholars, but we exported a lot of those saints and scholars. And Dovio Cronin speaks in the documentary, Professor Dovio Cronin from Galway, speaks in the documentary very well of the tendency of these early Irish monks to wander. He says they always have a wanderlust, these Scotty Peregrini, these wandering Irish. And in fact, there's one of the, on the continent, someone was complaining that these Irish, are there any, he was asking the question, are there any Irish left in Ireland? Because they all seem to be here on the continent. These philosophers, herds of philosophers are coming in and drowning the continent. And of course, they were hugely important, people like Colin Bannis. But not only Colin Bannis, before that you had, of course, Iona, and the Irish connection to Lindisfarne. We go there, we look at that. St. Aidan and Lindisfarne, who'd come from Iona. And of course, Colm Kyll had gone to Iona. So that whole strand of, I suppose, what they now call Celtic Christianity, but I would put that very much in brackets, like Irish Christianity, which then went into Britain and then went onward to the continent. And we travelled with Professor Imo Warnshez of Trinity, who's a scholar of Old Irish and of manuscripts. And we went to the Monastery of St. Gall, the library, most beautiful Baroque library in St. Gallen in Switzerland. And in fact, those manuscripts that we were looking at there are currently back in Ireland in the National Museum. There's a special exhibition on where they brought them home, these manuscripts from the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries. And I studied myself Old Irish in Trinity with Gordon Quinn, Professor Quinn, back in the day. And what surprised me initially was that the earliest Old Irish examples that we have, written examples of Old Irish, weren't in Ireland at all, but they were in continental libraries, and particularly St. Gallen. So that was fascinating to see some of the gospel books. But not only that, there was one particular thing that brought across, I think, again, the humanity of these people. You know, because again, there can be these like very dry figures. So in Priscian's Latin Grammar, which was one of the big texts of the early Middle Ages, and the Irish were fantastic grammarians, one of the monks, one of the scribes, I suppose, wrote in Ogham script. There was a particular script that one could use, a manuscript script of Ogham. And he wrote Lothart, L-A-T-H-A-I-R-T. And that means, oh my head, what a damn hangover I have. And I just think that is just hilarious, because, of course, nobody could understand that except another Irish scribe, who'd get a good laugh from it. And he was able to lament his drunken state and his sore head without alerting the European guarders of the crypts, you know. So I think that's really, really funny. But the other thing that I thought was really fascinating, when we were in Switzerland, we went from St. Gallen to Ein Siedl, a Benedictine monastery high in the Alps. And that's where a couple of years ago, Professor Imo Warnshez, he was just looking at manuscripts, and he found this particular manuscript that was written by an Irish monk sometime around the 9th century. He could prove that it was an Irish monk that wrote it from various, the signs they left and some of the words they were using. And it was the earliest work on the reckoning of time, you know, the Easter controversy. And it showed that the Irish monks, and he's made the point that Irish monks, and we expect them to be good at poetry and writing this and, you know, the gospel books and all that, but they were actually to the fore in what would have been the science of the day, astronomy and the reckoning of time, astronomy and astrology and all of that. And they were really, really, they were at the court of Charlemagne when he wanted an expert on this. Who did he call on? An Irish monk. So I suppose the whole thing of that is that really we can look back on that era with pride.
Incredible. And that first episode takes the story all the way up to the Vikings. And so that first episode, it really kind of sets the scene for so many of the themes that lead to that outpouring of the Irish diaspora.
Absolutely. And I think, I suppose, because the Vikings were here, they established a presence in the island. And we have both archaeological as well as written accounts of them being here. And we can trace where they went. And of course, they became themselves indigenised. They became the Hiberno-Norse. And they were soon, after a couple of centuries, indistinguishable, although they've left their mark in the DNA. But that story is really interesting and it's really complex. And again, has gone through many revisions, I suppose, as all aspects of Irish history have. You know, from the very simplistic nationalist view of these savage heathens coming and destroying our monasteries. But of course, they did as well. And one of the things, I suppose, that we use, one of the techniques we use, is to go back and to have actors read out contemporary accounts, in this case, the annals. You know, so they were quite illuminating what they said at the time. But of course, the Vikings, as I say, it's a very complex story. They gave us our major towns. They gave us coinery. They gave us a lot of words for maritime and trade and maritime affairs and trade. So they have contributed an awful lot to that mosaic of what it means to be Irish.
Jane, the second episode then, Contested Identities, takes the story from the arrival of the Normans all the way up to the defeat at the Battle of Kinsale. And it's such a crucial period of Irish history in terms of the changes there, these different identities, Normans, English, Tudors, all of that integration, conflict, all in this very turbulent number of centuries.
Absolutely, Patrick. And of course, this is taking us into the period of history with which people are more familiar from the, I suppose, Ireland is England's oldest colony, beginning with that Norman conquest in the 12th century. And we're very keen to explore that and actually, what did it mean to be Irish? Because often these Norman conquerors would come and they would see themselves as the English of Ireland. But of course, back in England, they were seen as the Irish. And then the Irish themselves saw them, obviously, as the colonists, the newcomers. But what's so striking is how quickly some of those early Norman colonists become integrated. They become Irish. They become Gaelicised, and things like the Statutes of Kilkenny from 1366. The whole point of that was actually to regulate the English colony in Ireland. And throughout the Middle Ages, we see these sort of attempts to anglicise or re-anglicise the colony. But it's really with the Protestant Reformation in the 1530s that we see colonisation on steroids begin again, because Ireland now represents a strategic threat to England because of the Catholic powers using Ireland as a backdoor into England. And it's really from this period on that we see settler colonialism as we understand it today, waves of plantation across the country, particularly in Munster in the 16th century, and then, of course, in Ulster in the 17th. But we also then see the emergence of what today we would call ethnocentric / racist ideologies about the Irish. Begins with Gerald of Wales in his writings, his Topographia, where he's describing the Irish as barbarous, uncivil, savage. And that rhetoric of othering is taken up in the 16th century by the likes of Edmund Spenser and others, because all of a sudden, no, the Irish are subhuman. They're dogs, they're cats, they're hogs, they're locusts. And that othering is very much an ideology of the English Empire. And we see it being born, if you want, in this period. But it's something that will take us right through into the early 20th century. So that particular episode is one that's very much focused on Ireland, but also looking at the Irish in the continent. And that's a major thread running through episodes 2 and 3. And our wonderful colleagues, we've got a number of colleagues based at universities across continental Europe, join us for those discussions. And then Marian Lyons from Maynooth and Tom Connors from Maynooth are there speaking to that early Irish diaspora, the clerics, the merchants, the mercenaries. And again, that story continues across episodes 2 and 3.
And in episode 2, the relationship with Spain is central to it, because that's the crucial ally in that conflict with England.
It's absolutely crucial. And there's some wonderful footage of Seville, of Simancas, where, of course, Red Hugh O'Donnell is buried. And interestingly, in a Franciscan cemetery, they're currently excavating it. Our colleague Susan Plavin doesn't think that they'll ever find his actual bones because they're all disarticulated. But and then going to the universities, I mean, Breanna and the team were very careful to give a lot of attention, quite rightly, to Spain, but also to Portugal, because I think when we think of that diaspora, it's very much focused on Spain, very much focused on France, but yet Portugal's a hugely important part of that conversation as well.
And episode 3 then, New Worlds, takes that story on, as you're saying, and you have the plantations, you have Cromwell, but you also have all of this migration to the New World, to Europe, to what becomes the United States, that it is such a, it's such an incredible story in terms of where the Irish go and what they do when they go there.
Yeah. By the 17th century, Patrick, there isn't a country in the world where Europeans have gone that you don't have Irish people. They're in the Philippines. They're all over Latin America. They're from Newfoundland right down into New Orleans, all over the Caribbean. So it's been really powerful to be able to tell that story of global activity. And they're there as part of spiritual empires. They're there as indentured servants. They're there as governors. And it's the sheer variety. And of course, we have to distinguish between, if you want, the Protestants of Ireland and the Catholics of Ireland, because the Protestants of Ireland tend to be there as the governors, as the military officers. The Catholics of Ireland, it's a much more mixed bag. You'll get some governors, but a lot of merchants. But then, of course, we have the indentured servants, the domestic servants. And I was so privileged to travel with the team to Barbados. And we actually filmed on a sugar plantation in Barbados. And they were harvesting the sugarcane as they would have in the 17th century. I cannot tell you what an insight it gave me into the heat, into the humidity, into the sheer brutality of it all. It was so powerful. And right through until the 1670s, we have Irish women serving in those sugarcane plantations alongside enslaved Africans. And of course, they often allied and rebelled fomented rebellion. Over time, though, whiteness did accord the Irish a level of privilege. And we would see that privilege really exemplified in the colonies, say, in Jamaica, where you would have some of the big plantations owned by the archdeacons, owned by the Kellys. And these guys, of course, are remitting their treasure back to Ireland. But the other place that we do a lot on the Atlantic world, quite rightly, but I was also really excited that we went to India, because Ireland's association with India really is very strong from the 1670s. The founding father of Bombay, that great financial capital of India today, Mumbai, was a man called Gerald Ainger from Ainger Street, just down the road. And he worked there for the East India Company. And we went to one of the forts that he had built back in the 1670s in Bombay. And it was, again, so powerful, so emotional to actually be standing there talking about the impact that this man had had on India. He set up the legal code. He planted Bombay the way his grandfathers had planted and colonised Ireland. He himself would have liked to have been regarded as English, but his fellows in the East India Company called him Irish. But his sense of Irishness was very closely held. And throughout his life, he maintained very close links back with his family here in Dublin. And Ainger Street was developed on the back of money that Gerald Ainger sent back to his brother, the Earl of Longford, who was the first property developer in 17th century Dublin. But he also sent things like mangoes, these exotic, exquisite Indian textiles back. And he brought the sort of exotic life of India to their estates in Longford here in Dublin. So it's such an incredible story, and a story that actually we know very little about.
Eileen, can we uncover new stories and new insights into Irish migration and the different groups involved from looking at burial sites, from looking at bones?
Well, yes, because you know, we can see differences in funerary practices, you know, between groups and with different religions. And, you know, again, we've excavated some large cemetery populations, you know, over in the west of Ireland, places like Ballyhanna, which is just outside Ballyshannon. And whenever we look at the remains of those individuals, you know, we know like there was quite a lot of conflict in that area, you know, between sort of the Anglo-Normans and the indigenous, you know, the local Gaelic population. So we can look for things like evidence of warfaring practices in the skeletal remains. And, you know, hopefully, you know, as the sort of the ancient DNA has kind of, you know, understood prehistoric times, there's the potential, you know, to start looking at more historic Irish populations. So that's something I think might shed new insights in the future about these different groups.
I know you've studied the lives of children in the past. How do children appear or fail to appear in Ireland's archaeological record?
Well, children are very much there. The problem was people weren't studying them. They didn't think there was much value in studying the remains of children. But now, you know, we've got a whole range of new techniques for, you know, getting very precise age of death values of children. And children are a real barometer of the health of a population. So when we find lots of dead children and lots of evidence of disease and, you know, vitamin deficiencies in the remains of our children, then we know that those populations were having a difficult time. You know, there was lots of environmental stressors. So, you know, again, we can sort of look at populations and see how they were, you know, thriving or not thriving, you know, by looking at the remains of their children. And there's probably stories tied into sort of migration and how well different populations were doing that can be told, you know, by looking at the juvenile remains in a population.
And Eileen, do you think the Irish archaeological record helps us rethink what it means to be Irish?
I think so. I mean, yes, if we go way back, you know, so we're looking to see if we've actually got Paleolithic people, so these would be, you know, the early humans. We now know that our Mesolithic people look very different to, you know, how people, you know, born on the island today might look. You know, our Mesolithic people, the DNA showed us that they would have had very dark skin and blue eyes, you know, which is quite an unusual genetic combination. We know then in the Neolithic times, we had another wave of people probably come in from Turkey and that sort of Anatolian region and brought with them, you know, all the new animals like that we're so familiar with today in our landscape, you know, the cattle, the sheep, the goats, brought with them, you know, new types of pottery, new ways of living. You know, so we see these major sort of changes that occur in the deep past that people don't necessarily realise happened. And, you know, when we sort of think about the stereotypical kind of Irish person, pale skin, red hair, you know, that kind of, you know, people have this notion, this kind of stereotype, but we can challenge that in archaeology by showing, you know, that people look very different in the past, you know, and now, you know, Ireland is such a multicultural place because of all the different sort of migrations. You know, it's very interesting to kind of look at the development and look at the impact of migration on populations.
Breanna, this year is the 250th anniversary of the birth of Daniel O'Connell, and I talked to you for the programme about Daniel O'Connell and his friendship with Frederick Douglass and his campaigns against slavery. And I see that episode 3 covers some of that area and also, I suppose, the Irish in the United States and some of those big questions and some of those big debates of that time.
Absolutely, Patrick. And I suppose as we up to episode 3, we've looked at, and indeed in episode 3 again, we look at Ireland's relationship with Europe. Previously it was with Spain, then became France, particularly as we move into the Age of Revolution. But as we move into that later 18th century, the Irish diaspora sort of changed. It changed in two ways. Who went and where did they go? So a lot more Protestants left. Now, Catholics also left, but they went to North America, to the British colonies of North America specifically. And there they became the frontiers people. These are the folk who went out to fight the Indians and to keep the frontier safe and to push it out. And then, of course, when the War of Independence broke out, these Ulster Presbyterians in the main took the Patriot side. They fought for the Americans against the British. And, of course, they would have had an animus against the British anyway due to the penal laws and the way they were treated back home in Ulster. So you also had Irish Catholics involved there, obviously. You had Commodore Barry, the famous Wexford man who founded the American Navy, James Hoban, who designed the White House. But it was primarily an Ulster Presbyterian story, that these people that would become known as the Scots-Irish in the US. Then, of course, back in Europe, you had the French Revolution. We have a very interesting anecdote about that in a sense, because obviously one of the most iconic and horrible things to happen during that would have been the death of Louis the 14th, the guillotining of Louis the 16th. And at that event was his confessor, who was a man called Abbe Edgeworth from Edgeworthstown in County Longford. And he had gone to France as a young man. He'd become a priest. He'd become very close to the royal family. And he was on the scaffold when Louis the 16th was executed. He not only was he in the scaffold, Louis's blood just poured down upon him, and he leaves that account in his writings and letters that are now in the Irish College in Paris, and Marianne Lyons brings us through that. And it's just a fascinating account of how an Irish man was witness to one of the, I suppose, the ending of a whole swathe of European history, the Ancien Régime, and the bringing in of the modern world, really.
And in terms of the campaigns against slavery and someone like O'Connell, how significant is that?
Oh, I think that's really significant. I mean, when I sat down to talk to you about this, I had known Frederick Douglass, obviously, had come to Ireland, and I knew he came to Ireland because he was a huge admirer of Daniel O'Connell. I hadn't realised how active Daniel O'Connell had been in the international campaign against slavery. I mean, I think one of the things that is really interesting is, you know, following the failed revolution of 1798, which was brief but very, very bloody, that the person who actually achieved freedom, also for Irish Catholics at least, for religious freedoms for and social freedoms for Irish Catholics, was somebody who was non-violent in his methods and in his aims. And I think Daniel O'Connell comes across as a colossal figure, as a colossus across the end of the 19th century, and was successful in many ways, obviously failed in his campaign for reform. But he left something. I think his legacy is hugely important. I think you brought that out in your contribution. His contribution, as like you said, he wasn't simply somebody who looked for Catholic emancipation. He was the civil rights campaigner par excellence in that period. And he was as concerned with suffering of the enslaved Africans in the US as he was with Irish Catholics or anybody who's oppressed worldwide. I think that global aspect of, if you endure suffering yourself, you don't turn and cause suffering to others. The opposite, you empathise with them and you actually help where you can. I think that's one of his legacies.
Well, tonight we are previewing this new documentary, From That Small Island, which is starting on Sunday, the 8th of June. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be previewing episode 4, From the Famine to the Future. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we're previewing this wonderful new documentary series, From That Small Island. And I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel, Professor Breena McDiarmida, who is the writer, academic and filmmaker who's involved in the production of From That Small Island, alongside Professor Jane Ulmer, Erasmus Smith Professor of Modern History at Trinity College Dublin, who's the historical consultant and was crucially involved in the production of it, and Professor Eileen Murphy, who's a distinguished bioarchaeologist at Queen's University Belfast and one of the contributors to the programme. Jane, episode 4 goes from the famine and looks all the way up to the future, and it brings in the election of John F. Kennedy as president. It deals with the aftermath of the famine and the huge migration and the mass emigration we see after that, the 1916 rising, everything about, I suppose, leading up to that question about what it means to be Irish today and the development of the building of a new, modern, diverse Ireland. But it is, in a way, a crucial episode in terms of the creation of the Ireland that we know today.
It really is. And to do that in a single episode was a huge challenge, you can imagine, Patrick. But for me, what is so powerful about it is that it really shows how the Irish take their place amongst the nations of the world. We see, of course, the demise of the British Empire that was triggered by the rebellion in 1916. And having helped to make empire, the Irish now play a critical role in unmaking it, not just here in Ireland, but in places like India and around the world. Obviously, it charts those difficult decades of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s. But then I think it takes us very nicely into the new Ireland of today, where roughly 20% of the people living in Ireland weren't born in Ireland. I mean, it's a very different Ireland to the one that De Valera lorded it over. So that final episode, again, is one. It tells that the story of how a nation has negotiated centuries of trauma and has managed to come out of it all the stronger. And it's a tremendous tribute to just the sheer human spirit that the Irish show around the world and here in Ireland.
And Jane, you can understand why the Department of Foreign Affairs has been such a great supporter of the project and so many other companies and individuals, because it's a story that's important for Ireland, it's a story that's important for the Irish around the world, and it's important for how we tell that story.
Very much so, Patrick. And I think, well, our hope is that this series will land very well, obviously with the Irish diaspora around the world. But I think any country that has been colonised will also really appreciate the story. And it's Brian and I are going to Latin America with the feature in September. We also hope to take to countries like India, where I think the audiences immediately get that story and find it very inspiring and compelling.
So, Brianna, that does bring us to that central question of what it means to be Irish today. And I wonder, does the series offer an answer to that, or is it something that we're still searching for?
A little bit of both. I think we answer some questions, particularly the early times. Who are the Irish then? Where do the Irish go? We answer those questions. But we finish with Professor Gerard O'Toig, and I've been a long-time fan of Gerard O'Toig. But we ask him that question at the very end of the programme, and he says the following: what it means to be Irish will not have a single answer, but what is most important is that it remains an abiding question. I think that is really, if people bring that from the series, I think that we need to be constantly, because that's constantly changing. We went from a nation of emigrants to a nation of immigrants. 20% of people living here were not born here. 19% of people born here don't live here anymore. And then we have the huge impact of the mass immigrations of the 20th century, of the 19th and 20th centuries. So I think that is the abiding question. What it means to be Irish will not be one single thing. It will not be one single colour. We'll have very interesting DNA evidence in the future when Eileen's descendants are digging up the graves of people born and living in Ireland today. So I think that is it. It has to remain an abiding question.
And Brianna, I suspect from what you're saying, it will serve as a rebuke to those who try to define Irishness in a particular way and as a narrow, exclusive vision, and are closed, and their minds and their hearts are closed to different types of Irishness.
I think it blows that myth out of the water.
Well, the programme is starting on Sunday, the 8th of June. It is going to be running over 4 weeks on RTE. And my thanks to my brilliant panel of experts for previewing it so well for us tonight. Professor Brianna McDiarmida, Professor Emerita of Irish Studies at the University of Notre Dame, Professor Jane Olmeyer of Trinity College Dublin, and Professor Eileen Murphy of Queen's University Belfast. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been talking history. Good night.